Good morning and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Kathleen Sabo. The spotlight has been shining on Ferguson, Missouri, following the police shooting death of Michael Brown. In Ferguson, where approximately 65% of the population is African American, yet policed by a force where 50 out of 53 officers are white, protesters have been met by officers in what appears to be full SWAT and military gear, carrying assault weapons and backed by armored vehicles. Images of the clashes between protesters and police have been broadcast and published, bringing home the reality of the militarization of police in the United States, the separation between the community and those assigned to protect and serve. Are the foundations of this separation and tension race-based, class-based, or otherwise? What steps can be taken to create a climate between communities and police that does away with this us-versus-them mentality, both in New Mexico and beyond? Joining me in studio today to discuss these issues are Amanda Gallegos, senior youth intern at the Southwest Organizing Project, or SWOP, where she has been focusing on the criminalization of youth and the school-to-prison pipeline; University of New Mexico Law School professor Alfred Mathewson, a former president of the New Mexico Black Lawyers Association; and Richard Moore, program director at Los Jardines Institute and senior advisor, Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice. Thanks to all of you for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. We'll be joined at the bottom of the hour by Brooklyn College sociology professor Alex Vitale, a member of New York's Police Reform Organizing Project. He'll join us by phone. So, Amanda, let's begin with you. Tell us briefly, please, about the mission of the Southwest Organizing Project, with whom you have been working.
Well, the mission is basically to empower the disenfranchised communities of color and to create change from the people who are affected by these issues.
Now, with SWOP, you have been focusing on the criminalization of youth. What is meant by that phrase, the criminalization of youth?
Well, when we say that, we mean that in the media, oftentimes when there's young people of color, the only way they're portrayed are as thugs or as gangsters, or even within these past shootings, portrayed as if they deserved it.
So this is something that's not happening to all youth. It's only to youth of color.
Yeah, mainly.
Okay. Richard, your activism roots are deep. When and how did you start working on issues involving police conduct in Albuquerque?
Well, it's been pretty close now to 50 years, to be honest with you. We began as a youth organization, both working on campus here. Many of us come out of our founding members come out of the Chicano movement. And so we've got a long history of working on many issues here in the city of Albuquerque in the state of New Mexico.
And did you, when you were involved long ago, did you see the targeting of certain groups by police? Was that your perception of things?
Yeah, actually, we really did. And unfortunately, history speaks for itself. We've seen and continue to see this issue as both class-based and race-based. That's very, very important for us to understand as we continue to engage in this issue.
Okay. Professor Mathewson, remind us a bit, please, about the Department of Justice's or DOJ's involvement, current involvement with the Albuquerque Police Department, and what is expected to come out of this involvement.
Well, Richard has been more involved with the actual process than I have, but as a result of all the police shootings in recent years, community activists pressured the Department of Justice to come in and do an investigation of the APD. There is a specific federal statute, the Violence Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, that authorizes the Department of Justice to do just that. Under President Bush, they used it to provide technical assistance to departments, but the Obama administration has used the statute to very aggressively go after police departments around the country. And so they came in and did an investigation and issued a findings letter back in April. And there is negotiations of a consent decree is now underway.
Well, now you've been working with or on behalf or at the suggestion of members of the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Center Task Force for Public Safety. What does that work entail?
Well, I'm working with Antonio Mastis, who's an attorney and state senator. We have a team of law students who are reviewing the consent decrees that have been entered into it up with other cities around the country, and are coming up with sort of a program for community education to the community about the process here going forward.
Well, let's jump into the meaty part of our discussion of race and police use of force and militarization this way. So here are three things that came before me yesterday. And the first is an unsolicited letter that came to our comments section. It says, and I've gotten permission to read it on the air, "Good day to you. On December 21st, 2013, our 13-year-old son, Red Bird Goodblanket, was experiencing an emotional episode. The episode escalated. He kicked out his bedroom window, and we thought he was going to hurt himself. We called 911. The end result was the death of our son. When authorities showed up, they never questioned us concerning the circumstances. They acted like military, entered our home with weapons drawn. There were two local sheriff's deputies and two Oklahoma Highway Patrol. We could see them pointing weapons into the kitchen. Moments later, his girlfriend ran out of the house screaming, 'Mom, they shot Bird.' These individuals shot him 7 times, once to the back of his head. Months later, the local DA, their boss, ruled it justified. Is there any difference between a black youth and an American Indian youth? My son had calmed down and was sitting in the kitchen when the four officers rushed and killed him." The writer goes on to say that the officers involved were given awards of valor by the Sheriff's Association, and that letter is from Melissa Goodblanket of Clinton, Oklahoma. The second thing that came to me yesterday, I watched last night, was a video of two policemen who happen to be white gunning down and killing 25-year-old Kajimi Powell yesterday in St. Louis, 4 miles from where Michael Brown was killed, after Powell allegedly stole soda and brandished a knife at his side and refused to obey officers' commands to stop while he allegedly shouted for the officers to shoot and kill him. They obliged him. And within 15 seconds of arrival at the scene, without deployment of any non-lethal defensive force, shot him dead. And the third thing that came before me was I took a quick look and reviewed the case of 23-year-old African-American Iraq service veteran Jonathan Mitchell, who here in Albuquerque, he was shot by his white neighbor in Vantana Ranch when he took off looking for a reported man with a gun in the neighborhood. Police helicopter video showed Mitchell returned to his own house and fired a shot as the neighbor pulled up. Seconds later, the neighbor pulled up and shot and killed Jonathan Mitchell. No charges have been brought, and the state police are now reviewing. Amanda, is my or our collective consciousness being raised to see police use of force against people of color, or is the reality that people of color are treated differently by the police and the justice system?
See, I think the reality is that our system is still racist. We don't live in a world that's post-racism, and oftentimes that's what we're taught.
Now, so that's a big statement, but let's dig in a little bit to what we see in Albuquerque. Are people of color treated differently by the police here in Albuquerque than white people?
I would have to say yes.
And what you've been out in the community, what statistics do you have, or information, or, and not necessarily numbers, but what does your examination tell you?
Well, I've seen some interesting things the last couple of days, but an example I saw on Facebook that wasn't necessarily in Albuquerque but in the country was that, so a man's dog got shot. This is a white man, and his dog got shot. And after this, the police that shot his dog got fired. And to me, that was a really good example of white privilege and how there is, you know, racial injustices and how we are treated differently.
Well, now, what kind of climate does this create for those who are subject to this more frequent police interaction or for use of force? What kind of climate does that create?
It creates that us and them mentality. And I've been reading this quote and I've been seeing it a lot, and it says, "Riots are the language of the unheard."
Mm. Richard, from your perspective and given your history and involvement with issues surrounding police conduct, has anything changed from the 60s when your involvement began to today?
Well, I think in to a large respect, it has. And let me just give a couple of concrete examples. One, I think that that if we look in, at the 1960s, for example, we were talking about militarization. We were talking about it in Albuquerque. We were talking about it in the state of New Mexico.
In the 60s.
And I'll just give you an example. If you look at the checkpoints coming in from the southern New Mexico into Albuquerque, driving towards Albuquerque, those checkpoints that are now are militarized. In the 60s, those were fruit checkpoints. I mean, you would come through there. They would ask you if you're bringing any fruits in from Mexico or any of this kind of thing. We talked in the 60s about the potential militarization of those checkpoints and so on. Very clearly, today they're militarized. We see armed military guards on those checkpoints and so on. I'll give you another example. In the 60s here, the Albuquerque Police Department couldn't go into the county. Only the sheriff's department could monitor the South Valley or so on. The Albuquerque Police Department couldn't cross over the river. No? Now, based on that, when you looked at it, the incredible racial profiling that was taking place during that time amongst African Americans, young, largely African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans, that kind of repression and constant push. Brutality and beatings and deaths of people in parks and so on, homeless people in the 60s and the 70s. So we need to understand that this is not a new issue to the state of New Mexico nor to this country today.
You know, I neglected to mention at the top of the show that we did invite someone from the Albuquerque Police Department to join us. And we've done that a number of times, and no one was available is what I was told. But we did want to get that perspective on here. We were unable to do that. We did also contact the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office and ask for someone to participate, and no one was available there. So I just want to let our panelists and our listeners know that we attempted to get that viewpoint on the panel today. Professor Mathewson, I'm looking at a document from the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial Task Force for Public Safety, dated June 9th, 2014, requesting the Department of Justice to amend its report detailing APD's use of excessive and deadly force to include, quote, institutional racism, barriers, and disparities, unquote, as elements in APD's use of excessive and deadly force. Why is this inclusion important or necessary?
Well, one of the things you started this in terms of asking about race and law enforcement and minorities of people of color treated differently. One of the things about the consent decree, the findings letter that DOJ did, what has happened is that this increase in the use of force by the police has spread beyond just treating people of color, that you now have instances where mentally ill are out in society without treatment, perhaps, and they have more encounters with the police. And so we're seeing more violence toward those. Both of the examples that you opened with were people of color who are also with mental illness. And so you have two areas where that led to encounters with police and the use of deadly force. Mm-hmm. So the DOJ came in looking at excessive force, not at the disparate treatment or the discriminatory use of force. So there is no finding in the findings letter about the discriminatory use of force. It is focused on the excessive use of force. And so the Martin Luther King Multicultural Council, our memorial center, was focusing on, wait a minute, there are issues dealing with race here in Albuquerque in terms of with the shootings that need to be addressed, and wanted to see the consent decree include a remedy that would address that.
Is that still in negotiation, to your knowledge?
The way the consent this process works, DOJ made findings. So if they go into court to get a decree and they're seeking a remedy, you need factual findings. So you would need findings of the racial disparities, and that was not the focus of the DOJ investigation.
All right. If you would like to join in our discussion about race and police use of force, there are several ways for you to participate. You may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org. You may post comments on the Collin Show webpage at kunm.org, or you may call our local number, 277-5866. That's 277-KUNM, or our toll-free number, 1-877-899-5866, with questions and comments. Tell us, have you had or witnessed an experience with the police that involved an escalation of the use of force? How did you react? We'd like to know. We'll be back with you shortly after this quick break, and we'll take your phone calls.
Whether it's politics, Native culture, or entertainment, the news stories that impact Native communities are what you hear on Native America Calling. Join us as we bring you the nation's first and only electronic talking circle, Native America Calling, from Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
KUNM programming is supported by the law firm of Rothstein, Donatelli, Hughes, Dahlstrom, Schoenberg, and Bienvenue, with offices in Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and Phoenix since 1976. For information, rothsteinlaw.com.
KUNM's Salsa Sabrosa for the best Latin dance music, Friday nights from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., the only place to hear the hottest salsa, merengue, bachata, cumbia, and more. Salsa Sabrosa, every Friday night starting at 7 p.m., only on KUNM 89.9 FM.
Welcome back to the KUNM Collin Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and today we're talking about race and police use of force. I'm joined here in the studio by Amanda Gallegos, senior youth intern at the Southwest Organizing Project, where she has been focusing on the criminalization of youth and the school-to-prison pipeline. I'm also joined by University of New Mexico Law School professor Alfred Mathewson, a former president of the New Mexico Black Lawyers Association, and Richard Moore, program director at Los Jardines Institute. He's a senior advisor to the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice. We invite you to join in our discussion. Right now, we'd like to take our first caller who's joining in our discussion. It's Glenn from Jemez Springs. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning. Thanks for this. We had a policeman here in Jemez Springs who is on the front page of our Jemez Thunder newspaper now as being arrested himself. His attorney says he is innocent of these charges, and that will be proven as this case moves forward. Then the next sentence is one I want to look at. This is yet another instance where police officers must be forever vigilant when they take people into custody. This particular policeman was active here for 7 months, did some good police work according to a lot of us citizens. He then hit the news there in Albuquerque and all over the place for as he was going to some outside convention. And it appeared to a lot of us that that convention was dealing with a lot of people off to the right. And it seemed to me and others that this policeman then started getting into some political things, some personal issues, and he ceased to do significant work. He even, after arresting some people, failed to keep his oath and go to court with these people. He was fired. This all raises the concern for me that police departments, I believe, need to have a psychologist on staff. They need to develop an atmosphere where their fellow policemen observe inappropriate, angry behavior of their fellow police and refer them to a psychologist, go to the chief and say, you know, this person is going to become a problem in the community. We are humans. All of us have our weaknesses, and our policeman here in Jemez Springs is a classic example of that. So those are my concerns. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your call this morning, Glenn. Richard, Is that something that has been talked about over the years, having a psychologist on the force? Maybe they even do at this point. I don't know.
I mean, I think it has, but I very clearly understand and appreciate the comment that was made by the caller. But I just want to take us, again, just another step into this militarization piece that we're talking about. Let me give you an example of what life very quickly is for those of us that live in the South Valley, that live in some of these areas. We're patrolled by 6 to 7 different kinds of police departments, and people need to very clearly understand that. One is the Sheriff's Department. The other one is the Albuquerque Police Department. The other one is the State Police. The other one's Immigration. The other one, for those of us that live close to railroad tracks, then the railroad tracks, that railroad property is also patrolled by a particular police department. For those of us that live close to the Rio Grande, to the river, there's the Bosque Police. And so those that come in on four-wheelers and so on that patrol the river and so on. And then in the wintertime, what we call in the South Valley the Smokestack Police, those are the police that drive around in the wintertime with flashlights in the evening, pointed to our smokestacks to see if we're burning illegally on a non-burn night. Now, there's other police forces that go along with this, and we need to very clearly understand this. So when it comes to militarization, when it comes to excessive force, and this is what the professor just said, and I need to comment to this, the DOJ very clearly, and you're knowledgeable of this, Professor, very clearly we know that much of that testimony that took place by behind closed doors and publicly talked about racial profiling and the other kind of things to the Department of Justice. No? So only focusing on executive excessive force primarily did not get to the root of what we've been talking about when we're talking about militarization, police harassment, police killings, and so on. So the testimony was there. The DOJ says that that they only have the charge of excessive force. And we've said over and over again, that's not going to be the total piece to this. So what I'm saying there with that is that, yes, we can talk about peace officers seeing psychiatrists. We can go on and on with those many kind of examples. But until we really get to the root of what's taking place here, not only in this city, but this state and this country, then they're going to continue to do what they're doing. Police officers that have been fired, sanctioned in other police departments in this city and in this state are coming to work for APD and working for police agencies. So it's not just Albuquerque. It's northern New Mexico. It's Santa Fe. It's Taos. It's Las Cruces. It's all over the state from both urban communities and rural communities.
You know, I was speaking with an elder in the African American community in preparation for the show, and she said to me, let's cut to the root of things here. The police are designed to protect the wealthy and the privileged, right, to protect corporate interests from people who might take away from that. There's a lot of money to be made here. I mean, that's what she felt was the actual root. She said she'd been told over the years by her elders that this was the root of policing in the United States.
Well, the organization that I was with in the 1960s and the 70s, many of us started off in the Brown Berets, and then we later switched to a new youth organization here called the Black Beret Organization. Again, just to say this, the communities, many of those communities, even with that kind of police repression that was taking place during that time, asked the Black Beret Organization to come in and patrol the communities and for the Albuquerque Police Department and other police agencies to stay out of the communities themselves. So very clearly, it's about corporate interest. It's about protecting the private property and so on of corporations and institutions and others, and in fact has nothing to do with the protection of the average citizen in the city or the state.
We had an email question, what percentage of the Albuquerque Police Department is Hispanic and what percentage is Black? One of the things I was able to get from the spokesperson from APD is a rough makeup of APD. It's 87.5% male. It's 12.5% female, 54% Caucasian, 39% Hispanic, and 7% other. So those are statistics are from APD. Let's go ahead and bring in our next caller. It's Bill from Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, everyone. Peace officers are exactly that. They're not warriors. Isn't it interesting that when APD does something wrong, their funding increases, like some kind of reward for doing something wrong. On the race issue, it's been systematically designed since the Constitution was written. We the people doesn't mean we all the people. At that time, indigenous people were considered savages. Black people were considered a percentage only human. So it's been systematically designed. And so that's my question, my comments. Thank you.
All right, Bill, thanks so much for your call today. Professor Mathewson, when you hear comments like Bill's, and you are a law professor and the Constitution is foremost in your mind, what, when we have an individual citizen who feels that way, what comes up for you?
Well, I train law students to become lawyers, and I became a lawyer to help be a solution, to help make the system work for people. And one of the problems that you see now is that we have a legal system. It has ideals, but for many people and in their encounters with the justice system, that includes the police, it doesn't work for them. But I believe in that system, and that's why I'm a part of it. And so I believe it can work. But we have to work harder to make sure that it does. So when I hear callers like that, I know what they are saying. I grew up with that and have known people and see it all the time, represented people, that we see that it's there. We have to change that. I thought that Reverend Sharpton sort of expressed it. We have had enough. So when you hear callers like that, that this has been going on before they were born, it's now 50 years since the civil rights movement, and still it happens. And what you're seeing is this desire for something different. They want something different. They want a police force that's different. They want to be protected by the police, not targeted by the police. So that's the, in terms of, we have to do a better job of making the system work.
Let's go ahead and take one more caller before we bring in our guest on the telephone. It's Charles from Albuquerque. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning. I just wanted to point out that you mentioned Jonathan Mitchell, the African-American U.S. Military veteran that was shot and killed by his white neighbor, but you failed to mention the part that the Albuquerque police played in Jonathan's death.
Well, please fill us in. Please fill us in, Charles.
Well, my understanding is Jonathan was shot in the arm, so it should have been a survivable wound. His brother was trying to administer first aid to stop the bleeding. When the police arrived, they pulled his brother off and handcuffed his brother. And then they let Jonathan lie there and bleed to death. That's my understanding. My understanding is even when the ambulance arrived, they were kept away and kept from helping Jonathan. And so Jonathan's death was very much due to police actions. And whenever Jonathan is mentioned, that should be pointed out, that he was not shot by APD, but they played a serious role in his death.
Well, Charles, thank you for adding that detail. And I know that that case is now under investigation by the state police, and we'll be looking to see what happens with that. Thank you for your call this morning. So before we bring in our phone guests, here's just a, we've been sort of skirting around the militarization issue, and let's, Richard, you've addressed it, but let's go ahead and put some numbers to it. This is from the Economic Policy Journal, taken from the Defense Logistics Agency. In 2013, last year, more than $400 million of military gear was given to state and local law enforcement. In 2013, approximately 200 armored combat vehicles were given to state and local law enforcement. And New Mexico ranks seventh in dollars worth of military gear received per sworn law enforcement officer from 2006 through April 2014. New Mexico has approximately 5,000 officers, and it's received $25 million plus worth of gear for a value of just over $5,000 of military goods transferred per sworn officer in New Mexico. Well, now I'd like to go ahead and bring in our guest. He's joining us by phone from the East Coast. He's Brooklyn College sociology professor and a member of New York's Police Reform Organizing Project, or PROP. It's Professor Alex Vitale. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning. And I know we talked about this before the program, and if you want to briefly add something to this discussion that we've been having here, you are certainly welcome. Is there anything in particular? I don't know if we have you, Professor.
There we go. I had a bad connection there for a second. Go ahead.
Yes. Is there anything, some brief kind of overarching comment?
Yes. Well, I think, you know, while it's important to focus and really drill in on this militarized policing thing, I think a lot of what we're hearing from our callers, from the other fantastic guests on the program, is really a problem of over-policing that's taking a whole variety of forms, including, you know, the inability to deal effectively with mentally ill people, the way the border is controlled, the way minor issues are being dealt with is all being escalated by the police.
Well, and, you know, we've got a link to your August 18th article for The Nation on our call-in show page website. That article is titled How to End Militarized Policing. And I want to just go ahead and read one or two passages that you wrote. Here you go. Ultimately, what underlies most of these militarized forms of policing is a cynical politics of race that has perverted criminal justice policies. They are no longer about crime or justice, but instead the management of poor and non-white populations through ever more punitive practices. And here's another passage. Christian Parenti reminds us in Lockdown America and The Soft Cage that the history of the police in the United States is a history of racism, and the militarization of policing is one expression of that history. While individual officers and police executives may be motivated by the best of intentions, as long as they continue to be the primary tool for managing social discord, poverty, and even crime, we will see a continuation of the over-policing of communities of color. It is this dynamic that is the most difficult to address and the most important. These are passages that you wrote. Given that foundational, cynical politics of race, how do we go about ending militarized and over-policing?
You know, one of your callers raised this issue of, well, police should be peacekeepers. And I think I want to actually turn that on its head a little bit. You know, functionally, what distinguishes the police from all other sort of agents of government is that they're the people who are authorized to come in and use force. And, you know, in any situation, any society, you're going to need someone who's able to use force in the best interests of society. But those usages of force should always be a last resort, should always be avoided at all costs. But what's happened instead is that over the last 40 years, an ever-growing list of things have come under the purview of the police, so that somehow we expect the police to deal with homeless people. We expect the police to deal with the mentally ill. We expect the police to deal with young people doing graffiti. And what I would argue is that we should instead be restricting narrowly the role of the police and understanding that the use of force is part of what they're there for. But the problem is we need other people, civilian people, to be dealing with all these other functions instead of, you know, police are never going to be agents of peace. That's just not the nature of that job. So what we need is different people to be doing that. Even when it comes to things like violent youth crime, there are people in communities, there are people who are trained as social workers, outreach workers, who I believe could be doing that work more effectively without engaging in criminalization and those kinds of punitive approaches that have led to these outrageous levels of mass incarceration in the U.S.
Well, we I know some of our panelists want to respond to you, but we have full phones as well. We need to take a break. I do want to invite people to join right now. The phones are full, as I said, but you may email comments to callinshow@kunm.org or to the Call In Show webpage at kunm.org. We'd like to hear from you. Can we get to a place where a community works with the police rather than continue with an us versus them relationship? How can we do this? We'll be back with you after a short break.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life.
Oh my God.
One thing I really like in a radio story.
What's back there?
Nothing. It looks empty.
That's no, there's someone living back there.
Is a mystery.
I'm not going back there.
There's somebody's hair. There's a head in there.
There's a shrunken head right there.
Mysteries explained each week. This American Life.
It's Santa Claus. Resident Evil?
Sunday afternoons at 4 on KUNM.
It's not every day you have a car or truck or boat or motorcycle or RV that you want to get rid of. But eventually, almost everyone has a vehicle that isn't worth trading in. Or it has body damage. Or it just doesn't run anymore. Or nobody's driving it for one reason or another. And that's the time to think KUNM. In fact, that's the time to think 888-KUNM-CAR. For that one time, that one call. 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Welcome back to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Kathleen Sabo, and we're having a discussion today about race and police use of force. We just heard by telephone from Brooklyn College sociology professor Alex Vitale. And, Professor, I want people to know that we do have a link to your article, and we also have a link to your webpage where people can view other writings of you. If people want to engage with you on Twitter, I know that you welcome that. And so what is your Twitter handle, please?
It's at A Vitale, A-V-I-T-A-L-E.
All right. And you, I'm sure you would invite people to engage in conversation with you at that Twitter handle.
Okay. Yes, I've been trying to talk about events in New York and Ferguson and more nationally and globally.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and bring in our next caller as we have full phone lines. It's Larissa from Santa Fe. Good morning, Larissa.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining our conversation.
I'm very pleased that you're discussing this. There should be so much media spotlight on these issues. And some of the local media have been reticent to do so. So I appreciate it.
Thank you. And you wanted to tell us a little bit about an event?
I have a specific experience with corruption within APD. My son was a 21-year-old UNM engineering student, and he was murdered by APD snitches in July 2009. That night, they chased away all the media, and none of the media, news stations, or the journal covered the murder. And that's how much control APD has here. Unfortunately, it went on. It's been 5 years now, and for 5 years it's been crippled and going on within the district attorney's offices, and the wrong people have been charged, and two blood-covered, scratched men that ran away from the murder that were picked up by APD and dropped off at another location later that night, they have never been investigated. I have tried to get the FBI, DEA, U.S. attorney involved. I've dropped off hundreds of pages of documents, and there's a very strange reluctance for them to do so as well.
Larissa, I'm sorry for your loss and that you are still fighting with the authorities about this. We thank you for sharing your story. It's good for listeners to hear people's personal stories in this regard, so thank you for calling today. Let's go ahead to our next caller. It's Barbara from Albuquerque. Good morning, Barbara.
Hi. Also really appreciate that you're doing this show. I mean, I think, you know, the difference between Cleavon Bundy, or however you say his name, and what's going on in Ferguson is an apt description of exactly what we're talking about here today. I mean, supposedly there have been guns reported in Ferguson, but no guns have been, you know, really documented there in actuality. I mean, people say there were guns. Police say there were guns and use this as an idea of, you know, the way they've been treating the crowds there. But one gun or two or three guns, I mean, we're looking at a huge encampment of white people with guns in Nevada and no response like we've seen. But I just want to mention that the NRA is holding a police shooting competition in Albuquerque on the weekend, starting the weekend of September 13th, and preceding that, 3 or 4 days of regional police pistol shooting. And I'm concerned that people aren't really paying attention to the idea that we actually are now having competitions, shooting competitions. We have now 350 AR-15s purchased by or received through grants, we're not sure which, for APD. AR-15s are now being issued to campus police. The National Park Service is militarized. I mean, everybody has all this equipment now, and it's a huge problem. And, you know, the team from Albuquerque includes a three-time cop killer of unarmed people. So these are the things we're facing, and I think people need to pay attention. There will be more information about this police shooting competition coming up, but I just want to remind people, these are the kinds of things that are going on. And I really appreciate your guest today, and thank you for taking my call.
Barbara, thank you so much for calling. Amanda, we saw a military response to protests right here in Albuquerque when protests were held by the University of Mexico. Were you involved in that situation at all? I mean, there were no guns there, were there?
Well, I mean, I kind of passed through, and I did speak to some people who went, and there were some people. One image that went around a lot was a man with an AK-47, and even though there was a gun, I think it was deeply symbolic. What he was trying to say is that they should be equally as scared of us as we are of them.
And I apologize if I said military response. I meant military-style response, so I just want to clarify that. So you're saying they were as scared of you as you were of them?
Well,
that was your perception?
I think in a way that, or I think that's what, there were some people who, a lot of times the image came around of a man who had an AK-47 with him at the protest. And that's what people were pointing towards, like, oh, kind of trying to justify the police presence. And I think what that man was going for was trying to put the police into our shoes, into the fact that they're so militarized, they all have guns, and they're trained, and we're just civilians. So it's setting us up to fail and setting us up to be murdered.
You know, I looked at a couple of articles last night, and one was, you know, of course police are afraid. We have so many guns in our society, which is true. We are a gun-laden society. And the other thing is that the militarization of police separates police out from the rest of us, sort of disengages them from the community, from what I can see. And Professor Mathewson, do you have any comments on any of that?
Well, one thing that's sort of striking is sort of what's happening there. If you've watched the images in Ferguson, one of the things that struck me were protesters standing in front of the police said, we are not afraid of you. Things are changing. That's why I think that we have to have an answer for them. We have to get this under control, because I do think there's a generation coming up. You have an African-American president. They expected things to be different, and it's not. You have these instances. Every time we make something a crime, it's another scenario in which there will be more encounters with police. I mean, that's the situation in Ferguson with the traffic stops, where they're raising revenue, and you get these disparities. But that engenders, I mean, there's a generation coming up now that doesn't know the tactics of nonviolence, and they're not necessarily thrilled with it. And so I'm concerned, unless we have an answer for them, and soon, it will, you're going to see more of those responses. It won't just be the symbols.
Well, Professor Vitale, we need to sort of imagine a future together with the police, do we not?
Yes, and I think that there are things we can do to make the police more responsive to communities, more accountable to communities, and I know this is really a big problem in New Mexico. We heard from your callers. I'm aware of some other cases. But we also, I think, need to dramatically reduce the role of the police and quit thinking that the police are the solution to many of the very real problems our communities face. Because in some cases, the use of the police is actually making those problems worse. And that's really the big challenge, I think, is when there's an uptick in crime or an uptick in disorder, instead of the first reaction being, well, we need the police to come in and save us, we need the police to come in and solve our problems, what we really need are political leaders to come in with comprehensive solutions to these problems that don't rely on mass incarceration and over-policing.
I want to go ahead and read two email comments and a comment and question that have come in, just food for thought. From Cynthia, police forces are often staffed by military veterans who need to be retrained to deal with American citizens rather than with enemies in war. That's a comment. Also a question from Richard. Why does officer safety trump citizen safety? Aren't the police tasked with protecting citizens first? Those are his questions. Let's go ahead and bring in Tom from Santa Fe, our next caller. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. First of all, thanks for taking my call. I teach in the Peace Studies program at the University of New Mexico, and I teach a whole series on something called community justice and another series on restorative justice. And I think these are ideas that are gaining ground in a lot of different places, but I don't see much of it here in New Mexico, and certainly not much in Albuquerque. But I want to speak to what might be fueling the militarization as well as the us versus them mentality. We began to see a pattern after Vietnam, and the previous comment you made really speaks to it, of ideas, tactics, weaponry. A war would filter back in domestic police departments. And we saw that pattern start, and we've seen it continue, only as the militarization has accelerated. The other thing I would say, and I'll go off of Dr. Mathewson's comment, I think it's a good one, is has to do with community engagement. And that is somewhat, from where I sit, an Achilles heel of the Albuquerque Police Department. There is very little substantial engagement. Public hearings, it's a very low level of engagement. So I think it's really important. I also think it's telling that no one from the police department has chosen to be part of the show today. The other disturbing piece for me, and having worked with the Department of Justice and having developed change management programs for justice agencies around the country, one thing that's telling here is there, to this point, there has been no public acceptance of responsibility on the part of the city or on the part of the department itself. And that is, if change is going to happen, training, it's going to take a lot more than training officers. You know, these are organizational culture issues from the leadership on down. And I don't think accountability by firing people is going to change the culture. So I'd like to hear maybe your panelists speak to the business of both community engagement as well as the need for organizational culture change, which seems to have escaped the conversation to this point.
All right. Thanks so much for your call this morning, Tom. Let's go ahead and get Richard. And we only have a few minutes left, unbelievably, but we only do. So, Richard, how would you like
to
respond?
Well, you know, I wanted to respond by saying, at least in terms of my age, I remember actually police officers walking the streets, walking and patrolling the neighborhood, a lot more of interaction with community, a lot more responsibility and accountability in terms of community policing and this kind of thing. I think the other thing in terms of the militarization that we're speaking about is that, quite frankly, the APD has a shoot-to-kill practice and doesn't necessarily have a shoot-to-wound practice. I say that because many of these police officers have been trained, as has been said by our callers, in the military as sharpshooters and stuff. So I'm quite sure, and many of us in our communities are aware, that they could shoot somebody in the leg or shoot somebody in the arm or whatever, And the documentation speaks for itself in terms of the number of people that are wounded compared to the number of people that have been killed. The other thing is if you're awarded, for things, I mean, we see that with an APD now, buying more rifles, the U.S. government donating equipment, military equipment that may have been in Afghanistan, little mini tanks and all these kind of things. If you're awarded, why should you back off? Quite frankly, some of that corruption and brutality within this police department continued to take place while the Department of Justice was here doing its own investigation. The union, the previous president of the union itself, giving money to those that were responsible for some of the shootings and whatever. So if you're awarded for things, then why wouldn't the practice of that continue? So that speaks for itself, I think.
And Professor Mathewson, talking about community engagement, I mean, is there a place at the table? I mean, are people being welcomed in to talk about issues, or is it a closed door?
Well, I think there's been a lot of input already in terms of what's going on here. The community pressured the DOJ to come in, and so there has been community input thus far. But there needs to be more in terms of completing the process, in terms of what you really want to see with the police. And then even after you have a consent decree and ongoing, there's still this need for the community engagement, just in terms of police and the day-to-day, the officers in the neighborhood that you get to know them. There are aspects of it in terms of you need to be able to communicate to the police and have a relationship in which there's this give and take, and the police understand what it is that the community wants, and the community has an opportunity to bring that about, to change the police.
Amanda, do you feel that youth or even the Southwest Organizing Project have been welcome in the discussion?
No, I mean, not all the time. And in my eyes, as a community organizer, that is the solution, is that there needs to be more space for the community to hold APD accountable, and we're not always welcome at that space. So in my eyes, that would be the solution. And also to try and, like Richard had kind of said, to have APD engage with the community more so that they feel less inclined, or that it's less okay to be shooting the community that they're supposed to be serving.
So both sides feel like it's less us versus them,
yes.
Whoever the us is and whoever the them is. Alex Vitale on the line there. We are not going to get to a caller who did want to link poverty and homelessness into the equation here. And I'm going to encourage that caller, whose name I no longer see, to engage with you again on your, if you'd give us your Twitter handle, please.
Yes, at A Vitale, A-V-I-T-I-A-L-E, A-V-I-T-A-L-E.
And we just have a few moments, and I would like our other panelists got an opportunity here to talk recently, and I'd just like to see if you have anything you'd like to say briefly in a wrap-up.
Yes, I was thinking about what Amanda said, and I'm wondering if it wouldn't be better for her community and the young people she works with if there was a way for groups like SWAP to have more power and more of a role in managing problems in the community rather than trying to get the police to just be more respectful, which we need to do. But really, I think we just need to rethink the role of the police in those communities and come up with alternatives to policing rather than just improvements in policing.
All right. And I want to let our listeners know that tomorrow night on New Mexico PBS, New Mexico In Focus, the program will be about Albuquerque's police department and families who have lost children to police shootings. That's Friday night, tomorrow night at 7 p.m. on New Mexico PBS. I want to go ahead and thank our guests, Amanda Gallegos of the Southwest Organizing Project, University of New Mexico Law School Professor Alfred Mathewson, Richard Moore, Program Director at Los Jardines Institute, and Brooklyn College Sociology Professor Alex Vitale, for making themselves available to our listeners on this very important topic. Thank you to all of you for being here. Thanks also to our callers for helping to develop our discussion today. Thanks to our engineer, Roman Garcia, and our assistant producer, Kaveh Movahed. Michael Hess has handled our phones today. Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. I'm Kathleen Sabo. This has been the KUNM Call-In Show on 89.9 KUNM and KUNM.org, a public service of the University of New Mexico.